It is necessary to investigate before legislating. But the line between investigating and persecuting is a very fine one.
The investigators tell us it seems the suspect was going to pass them, then turned and fired.
Laura, what you're seeing behind me is one of multiple locations.
I rise to support the impeachment of President Donald J. Trump.
And I'm about to talk to him about allegations that he was involved with prostitutes in Moscow and that the Russians taped it and have leverage over him.
Colonel Douglas McGregor. Sir, thank you for coming on. I know you're busy. I've seen you all over the web for the last few weeks. So for one Scotsman to another, thank you for coming on. I appreciate it.
Well, Todd, thanks for inviting me. I appreciate it as well. It's an interesting green room, too. It's the strangest green room I've ever been in.
Well, you made it. Look, there's a lot I want to talk to you about, but this morning they came out with a former Ukrainian official who's corrupt. I've done some research on him. Saying it's now time for the new Ukraine. We're going to bring in Indians and Africans and Pakistanis, and the new Ukraine is coming. And it's obvious to me this has been about killing all the Christian Slavs. What say you?
I think it's hard to make a counter argument.
Yeah.
It's not just Slavic Christians. This is part of the larger globalist plan to destroy Europeans in general and white people, you know, at large.
Yeah.
And this is not a new development. You know, you've got to go all the way back to the Frankfurt School. I don't know if you've discussed that with your audience or not. Are you familiar with it?
I am. We haven't gone into it deeply, so go ahead.
No, well, I was just going to point out that if you Google Frankfurt School, I'm talking to the audience now, and be specific, use the German spelling, but when you get there, there'll probably be several different ones. But the truth is that this was a group of people that today I think we call cultural Marxists or simply Trotskyite Bolsheviks, you know, whatever you like. And they cooked up this notion that the way to make Europe a better place for them in terms of their ideological preferences was to bring in as many people from the Middle East, North Africa, Central Africa as they could. And eventually what they would do is eliminate us racially. Outbreed all of the people that are white and replace them with some mix, which they were comfortable they could then govern. You know,
they wouldn't
encounter much resistance to any of the dumb ideas they might come up with. Well, this is sort of being resurrected, repackaged, and presented to us as globalism. And this globalist movement has been well underway and in great strength since, I would argue, certainly the latest 2015. With the mass migrations into Europe.
Yeah.
Of course, this was Joe Biden and his contemporaries, his friends on, we say the left, I don't know what you'd call it, but, you know, obviously that's why we opened our borders and invited large numbers of people in that were not like us, that didn't share our culture, our values, our history, our experience. And it's had a damaging impact on us. And of course, as soon as you bring this up, you know, you're immediately tarred as a racist or something else, which my answer is, well, that's fine, because it appears that the most racially conscious people are not white.
Yeah.
I grew up in a neighborhood in North Philadelphia where it became almost universally black. And let me tell you something. Racial identity was very, very important to all of the people that I grew up with that were black.
Yeah.
So, you know, wake up, smell the coffee. We live in the real world. Religion, language, culture, race, these things matter. And what you're talking about in the context of Ukraine is a perfect example of that. Kill off the core population, destroy the gene pool, then go ahead and encourage everybody there who is truly Ukrainian to leave the country. And then we can bring in others to replace them. What a wonderful idea. And this is what we have been bankrolling. This is what we've been supporting in the form of Mr. Zelensky, who is frankly an archetypal Bolshevik.
Yeah.
We're castigating and attacking the Russians for fighting it. That makes no sense at all.
So you mentioned Trump. What does he know? I mean, where are we on Mr. Trump, President Trump? He's enabling a lot of this. He says a good game, but He's still funding the war. He had Pashinyan in the White House today. He just arrested six apostolic priests in Armenia. They're attacking the church in Armenia, attacking the church in Ukraine, in Romania. What about the White House? Where are they on this?
Well, the White House is full of globalists. Maybe they call themselves neocons as opposed to globalists, but frankly, that's what's running the show. And their only concern at this point, as far as I can tell, is the survival of Israel. They certainly don't seem to be terribly involved with the survival of the United States or the American people. My assessment of President Trump, who, by the way, I like personally, very nice person. When you meet him in public, you encounter a very different personality from the one you see on the stage.
Yeah.
But I think he's somebody that operates in two distinct directions. One is optics. If it looks good, if it sounds good, if it advances me personally and whatever I think my agenda is, then it must be good. So he loves the stage. He loves standing in front of the American flag like George C. Scott and haranguing an audience of men in uniform. He loves that. That's wonderful. He was a little shocked when he walked onto the stage after Hegseth made his remarks, and no one applauded or cheered him. It was very strange. I guess he knows absolutely nothing about the professional military. And when the commander-in-chief comes in the room, you stand at attention, but you don't cheer and applaud anybody. This is not a political rally, but that's what we effectively saw. So that's one side of him. So what you saw in the Knesset over in Israel is another example. Here's the big stage. Lots of applause. He gets to stand up there and wax eloquently, if you want to call it that, about his views and the people he knows. That's one part. The second part is that he tends to equate edicts, things he directs, with action. Oh, I told them to do this. Well, unfortunately, we live in a world where if you don't check to ensure it's actually being done, you may discover not much has happened. So, you know, when you look at the border today, is it improved? Absolutely. The massive influxes are not occurring. But is the border really secure? Answer is no. The human trafficking, the drug trafficking continues. Much of it moves through the legal ports of entry, which is disturbing. But it's pretty tough when you're dealing with a drug cartel that can pay all the customs officers $30,000 extra every month to turn a blind eye to anything they want to move in or move out of the country. So you have trucks coming out of the United States that are loaded with cash from the top to the bottom. No one stops them, lets them through. Then the truck comes up and who knows what may be in it. If it's important and they've been alerted ahead of time, which is usually what happens, they get through. The coastal waters are not secure. The harbors are not secure. Our airports are not secure. And then there's this notion, well, we're going to go bomb Venezuela or attack Venezuela, and this is going to contribute to the war on illegal human trafficking and drugs. Not much. It's a distraction. It's not even a major hub. The major hub is Colombia.
Do you think that's what that really is about, though? I think it's more about the Maduro regime itself. What do you think?
Well, I think it's part of it. You know, to be perfectly frank, I just wrote something that should be out on X, I hope, soon. It tries to explain that this appears to be about resources,
yes,
oil and natural gas. And Maduro is not a fool. Whether you like him or not, doesn't matter. He went, I guess, to the U.S. government or sent his representatives and said, rather than invade us and execute this regime change operation, which is another Trotskyite, you know, international Bolshevism product, he said, why not take a major stake in our oil and gas industries? Well, I think that's a great solution. I mean, first of all, as an American, I don't want to rule people in Venezuela. So I don't want to take the place over. That's just a nightmare. There are 30 million people down there. You have a 1,700-mile coastline. The border with Brazil is 1,379 miles long. The border with Colombia is 1,380 miles long. You really want to make yourself responsible for that? That's insane. Why not do business with these people? Well, now you're back to the regime change operation. It's this scorched earth notion. We dress it up and say, you have to be a liberal Democrat like us. But there's no evidence for that because Zelensky is effectively a Stalinist.
Yeah.
He's running the country as though he were Stalin. That doesn't seem to bother anybody in Washington, or at least the people in charge. Look at our friend Netanyahu. He's effectively a dictator. You know, he's beating down anybody in the Israeli population that doesn't like what he's doing. That doesn't even begin to address what he's doing to the rest of the people in the region. But my point is, that's all nonsense. This is about power. This is about, I think, they think, restoring some prosperity to the American economy by acquiring other people's resources. I'm sure the bankers in New York City are delighted. The bankers in London are probably delighted. We failed in Russia. We failed with the regime change operation. We wanted to break up Russia, strip Russia of its resources, steal everything they have, and then dictate life to them. That's failed. Then we turned to the Middle East, and we've been trying to figure out a way to get control of Iran's oil and natural gas resources, partially because we want to keep it from reaching China. Of course, China is smarter than that and has built this One Belt, One Road, this overland transportation infrastructure with trains and trucks and automobiles that run from Central Asia all the way to Europe or down into Iran or from Iran up into Central Asia. In other words, we're trying to control the resources and have been now since the 90s in a way that will apply a chokehold to China. Well, you can imagine the impact on the Chinese, just as you can imagine the impact on the Russians and the Iranians. All we've done now is split the world. We now have BRICS on one side, a new financial system emerging much more quickly than I think we ever anticipated, Todd.
Yes, I know.
And this system is going to be backed by gold. And the Chinese, who have plenty of gold, they've been buying it now for years. They're setting up vaults, one in Riyadh at the moment and another in Hong Kong. And
I saw that too. Yeah.
All the international exchange back and forth over borders is changing from dollars, in many cases, into yuan. So the Saudis are doing business with China in yuan. The Indians are doing business with the Chinese in yuan. I mean, everything is changing. The world is de-dollarizing. So effectively, Donald Trump is standing in a house that's burning down. And he's saying, don't worry about this. We have plenty of fire hoses and plenty of firemen. But the house is on fire.
Well, I noticed that they immediately after that proposal went to D.C., they terminated negotiations with Venezuela.
Which doesn't make any sense. I mean, you know, avoiding war should be a guiding strategic imperative.
Yeah.
Anything you can do to avoid a conflict should be done. I mean, we criticize, or I don't, but a lot of people criticize the British Empire. But if you look at the British Empire, they actually practice what I call economy of enemies. They would look at an entire country, an entire region, half the continent. They would say, well, who are the people that will do business with us? And who are the people that won't? Then they set out to make friends with all the people that will do business and isolate the ones who won't. But the last thing they did was attack anybody. That was the last resort. And they very rarely had to attack anybody because once they isolated the one individual country or nation or tribe or clan or people that didn't want to do business, it was easy to close in on them and compel them to change their view. So the idea of using military power down in Latin America anyway is crazy. Everything in Latin America is blamed by everybody that lives in Latin America on us. It's sort of like the United States and China. You say, well, this is bad. And then somebody says, China. China's responsible. Oh, yeah. China stole our manufacturing base. China's stealing IP. Well, as my Japanese and Korean friends with whom I've done business say to me, why did you let them into your laboratories?
Exactly.
Why are they in your universities?
Why are we keeping them here?
Yeah, exactly. And the Chinese have been thrown out of countries all over Asia. Yeah. The Vietnamese threw them out lock, stock, and barrel a few years ago. We are not being realistic. And that's because nobody really knows what the hell they're doing, I think. And so everything is impulse driven. And then you have a lot of people, these neocons or globalists around Donald Trump, that are saying, oh, this is a great idea, Mr. President. And in the meantime, they're cutting deals on the sideline, bringing hundreds of millions of dollars into their respective bank accounts.
Yeah.
It's not a good picture.
Yeah, on that note, it played in the cold open, Mark Root at NATO. Just a clown show of comments, I thought, came out this morning in the last few days. You know, Russia is weak. Russia is, you know, making fun of them, you know, the stupid MiG-31 jokes. I mean, what the hell's going on here? I mean, they want a global war, I guess. Is that what's going on?
I think there are a couple of things that are going on. One is... they don't really believe that the Russians will respond. Whereas I think their view is, and they have some evidence for this, that the Russians don't want a war with us. Well, they don't. They're very intelligent, prudent people. Mm-hmm. We should not want a war with them, but we certainly are giving a good imitation of it. So that's part of it. The second part is, there's a certain amount of self-deception involved. In other words, if you continue to profit because you are on the team with all of the other people that want to drag us into the pit, so to say, and want war with Russia, and your bank account is filling up, you're benefiting from deals. Mr. Ruta is not going to retire to oblivion when he leaves. He's going to retire to a very comfortable existence. So did Stoltenberg. Yeah. All of these people are in that game. Well, they're cooperating with the globalists and the neocons that are running the show inside the White House. And if you're willing to cooperate with this sort of globalist agenda, you can make a lot of money right here in the United States. There are all sorts of financial firms in New York City that reward you with huge quantities of money. I mean, there are reasons that Dave Petraeus is working for KKR.
Yeah.
There are reasons why Jack Keane comes on and says what he does. You have to look where he's associated in New York. In other words, these financial interests permeate the United States and its society. It doesn't do anything for the American people. It doesn't do anything for the average American, but it certainly does reward their sort of obedient servants when it comes to the global agenda.
And then you have Kellogg, who's got a daughter with an NGO in Ukraine, you know, that makes money on the war continuing, and he goes over. I mean, it's just up in your grill, as they say.
Well, he says the Russians are weak. The Russians are incapable. You know, they make these comments. Well, look, they haven't moved very much, and they're not really controlling all of Ukraine. Well, here's the newsflash. They don't want to control all of
Ukraine. Why would you? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they don't want to be responsible for Western Ukraine, and they know the Western Ukrainians from their history don't want to be ruled by Russians. By the way, they didn't have a very happy relationship with the Poles when the Poles ruled Western Ukraine.
Yeah.
The Western Ukrainians are a pretty stubborn lot of people, so the Russians don't want to have to do business with them. They want them to be neutral. They don't really care what they do in Ukraine as long as it's not threatening them, and they would like a neutral belt between themselves and NATO. Not an unreasonable request,
no,
my judgment.
No, it's not.
When I was at Shape headquarters in 1998-99, Ukraine would occasionally come up for discussion. And the joke was, where does Ukraine begin and Russia end? Because half the Ukrainian troops that you ran into spoke only Russian. And I knew a few words of Ukrainian because I grew up with them in North Philadelphia. And they said, I would say to speak to them in what I thought was Ukrainian. They would look at me and they would say, that is Western Ukrainian. That is not Ukrainian. I mean, it's going to be a war.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just ridiculous. And that was the first part. Second part was, Ukraine has an important mission. It puts 500 or 600 miles between us and NATO and the Russian military establishment. That's their mission. So we've destroyed all of that with this NATO expansion, which is really part of this larger global agenda.
Well, and people don't realize that, you know, Vladimir the Great came from Kiev. I mean, it was Kiev and Rus before. That's where Russia came from. So to have this war is just insane, in my opinion. Let's talk about the big kahuna in the room, the Tomahawks. Medvedev came out yesterday and said, you know what? These are nuclear capable. How do we know if one's coming in, if it has a nuke on it or not, or a dirty bomb, or the Zelensky put in there or whatever? I mean, a good point, right?
It's a legitimate point. Now, I would point out to your audience that President Trump or one of his underlings has said that we're looking at 20 to 50 Tomahawk missiles. Now, we have to understand that not all Tomahawk missiles are the same.
Sure.
Because some missiles are fired from aircraft, some are fired from ships. And then you have a small number that have actually been designed to be launched by the U.S. Army on the ground.
I saw that.
Mobile launchers. Trucks.
Yeah.
Now, the problem with the missiles that the U.S. Army has is that they're a little, they've been modified for ground launch, but more important, they have a different warhead. Mm. I don't know how many of those warheads we actually have. If somebody said between 20 and 50, my suspicion is not very many. That's the first thing. Now, the second thing on nuclear weapons, it would help a great deal if Mr. Trump would say publicly, I will not under any circumstances initiate a nuclear strike on Russia. Off the table. Forget it.
Yeah.
Remember when Biden first started talking about helping the Ukrainians and somebody said, what about F-15s? He said, that's off the table. You know, that could lead to a global war. Why? Well, it has the capacity to deliver a nuclear warhead. You know, then other questions came up. Well, what we would benefit from terribly at this point is from the president simply saying, we will not use a nuclear weapon, period. Now, whether or not the Russians choose to believe that based on our track record, that's another matter.
Yeah.
But I sure as hell think that would help. But I don't see any evidence that that's coming because I think the opposite is likely the case. Somebody's telling him, well, Mr. Trump, let it be ambiguous. Let them worry about that. And he probably sits there and says, yeah, that's right. Yeah, we'll not help. We don't want to help them out. Let's make them worry. No, Mr. President, let's not make them worry. Because there are lots of people in Russia right now that would love to nuke us. They hate us for everything that we've done to them. The one man who is the adult in the room and exercises tremendous restraint over all of that is Vladimir Putin. He does not want a war. He understands what that means. His family lived through the siege of Leningrad. He knows what war is. So no, he doesn't want a war. But we're not thinking in those terms. We're meddling. We're playing. There is no strategy. There are just tactics.
Yeah. Stupid tactics.
Yeah. The goal ought to be end the war. When he was elected, when he ran for office, I sat there and said, thank God, Trump gets end the war.
So what happened? Is it just he's surrounded by a bunch of, you know, globalist warmongers? Or is he not getting information? Or what's going on, do you think?
I think it's all of the above.
Yeah.
The Tomahawk missile is an older system. It has a range of about 1,000 miles, maybe a little more. Its payload, in other words, the explosive warhead is about 3,300 pounds. Is it an effective weapon? It can be. But to be frank, integrated air defenses in Russia would probably shoot most of them down. That's not enough, though, frankly, because if only two or three get through, they hit a neighborhood. And that's one of the favorite tactics the Ukrainians have had for some time now, which is to kill as many Russians as they can, or to aim it at a nuclear reactor on the ground at one of these nuclear power stations.
Yeah. You know,
that sort of thing could be devastating. So it's not, I don't want to create the impression that this is not a big deal. It is a big deal, but the system has a number of limitations.
It's more of a psychological thing, right? I mean, it's more of like, it's just known as a nuclear weapon. So it creates this, you know, this aura, if you will.
Well, we have that horror with the F-35. We put F-35s in places and the Russians have no way of knowing whether or not that's carrying a nuclear weapon or not.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is why it's so important to be very clear. When you're in a situation like this, just short of all-out war, but with the potential to go to all-out war, you don't want to be ambiguous. You want to make your intentions very clear. And again, before he was elected, it was obvious that his intentions were to end the war. And he ought to go back to that. And at this point, I don't think we have any credibility. He can't walk into a meeting and be taken seriously. Anchorage was a great idea, but it was a complete loss because his entire team walked in there without having studied the Russian proposals.
If you haven't noticed, gold has reached a new high, all-time highs, actually, and keeps going up every day. Why is that? It's because precious metals are a long-time historical store of value. And if you own a portfolio and you have assets in the fiat currencies, i.e. stocks, bonds, cash, or whatever, you're vulnerable to hyperinflation, which is coming as our debt explodes another trillion every 90 days. It's really scary. So how do you protect yourself? Go to Advisor Metals. If you look on any of our CDM.press sites, about halfway down, there's an ad for Advisor Metals. Click on it. fill out the form for your contact info, and Igor Bashatsky will contact you and talk to you. It's an easy conversation. There's no sales pitch. He's completely verified by us. He has a regulatory background we've checked into. We've checked with his bankers. We've checked with his IRA custodians for metals. And we can highly recommend Advisor Metals and ERA. So go to Advisor Metals. If you call them directly, tell them we sent you at CDM, and he'll definitely take care of you. But protect your portfolio, because you really need to. It's coming. Thank you.
This is a special report.
Knowing how to invest your money is harder than ever before. Dealing with stock market volatility, record debt, and terrorist attacks requires new thinking. At U.S. Asset Management, we can help you see the world more clearly so that you can move beyond the chaos and invest with confidence. Call us, visit us online, or drop by our office. U.S. Asset Management, helping you make better decisions with your money.
Your government doesn't care about you. That's why you need a medical emergency kit. It contains life-saving medications like ivermectin, Z-Pak, and antibiotics. Stock them before they block them.
They had no counterproposals, and they sat there, and surprise, surprise, the Russians outlined their position again. Now, what the Russians expected, I know this for a fact, is that they thought that President Trump's team would come in and say, we've looked at these 10 points that you've outlined. We're comfortable with these six or seven. There are three that are sticking points for us, and we'd really like to do a deep dive there and understand what this means. Because if there's some flexibility on these three, then we may be able to come to an arrangement. That's what the Russians looked for. That's what they expected. Nobody came in with anything. So everybody sits there. The Russians tell us what they've told us repeatedly. And President Trump, who thought he was just going to overwhelm everyone with his charm in this hugely staged event showing combat aircraft flying overhead and combat aircraft on the tarmac, all of which the Russians are familiar with. It was not a surprise. What we got was nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing.
What do you think about Kirill Dmitriev, who runs one of their rainy day funds, I believe, and also Luna was given a bunch of information on the JFK assassination. There's been some, I guess, olive branches from Russia recently. Do you think, is that the way you take them?
I don't know. I mean, I just don't know enough about it. I don't know the details or the people involved with it. I don't think anyone should be surprised that the Russians would like to get past this state of permanent hostility with Washington. Mm-hmm. But they're learning that any attempt they make is ultimately thwarted, not necessarily by Trump himself, but the people around him.
Yeah.
And Trump listens to them. I mean, if you're going to listen to bad advice and then implement it, ultimately you are responsible.
Yeah. The buck stops here. Let's move to the Middle East. I'm speaking in Beirut in about 10 days. I've been there often. I've been to Armenia. The attack on Christianity, the Christian church, from the apostolic, pathway up from the Holy Land through Lebanon into Armenia, where you had the genocide. All this history is coming back. And there's a massive attempt to destroy any shred of Christianity in the region. Is that the way you see it? That's the way I take it.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you have a problem here in the United States with the evangelical Protestants in particular.
Yeah.
First of all, there's a lot of ignorance in the United States about what I would call Orthodox Christianity, mm-hmm. or the Armenian Christians or the Copts in Egypt. Mm-hmm. There are people that go to their respective church, Baptist, Presbyterian, Methodist, whatever it is, and they're certainly aware of Catholicism. But they're not really sure about any of these other people, and what are they?
Yeah.
So there's a lot of ignorance about what those forms of Christianity are about. That's a huge problem. Recently at this event that we held, the first one on the National Conversation, there was a lady who was present for this who had lost 22 family members in Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
She was a Palestinian Christian.
Yeah.
And a Roman Catholic. And she explained that the church in which many of her family members were killed was one of the oldest in the world. If it's not the oldest, then it's maybe number two on the list for Christian churches in the world. And her story was heartrending. And she talked about, her life as a Palestinian. And we have this other very misleading picture of Muslims. just as there are various kinds of Christians, there's a lot of diversity in the Muslim world about Islam. Mm-hmm. Not every Muslim wants to kill his daughter over an honor killing. Not every Muslim believes in the implementation of Sharia law. And the interesting part about the Palestinians is that among Muslims in the Middle East, they are probably closer to the secular variant than any other. And what's even more interesting about it is, as an Israeli officer once told me, he said, Doug, they are the Jews of the Arab world. I said, what are you talking about? He said, they're very intelligent. They tend to be well-educated. They work hard, and they're treated badly by the Arabs, who resent them. I mean, it's a strange set of circumstances.
Yeah.
So I don't know what you do to educate Americans about Christianity. And I'm not saying that we should go on a Christian crusade to kill everybody that doesn't like Christians. But we ought to be a little more sensitive to this reality and stop pretending that the Israelis, for instance, give a damn about Christianity. They don't. Overwhelmingly, they don't. In fact, they have a very, you know, I would say, negative opinion of the whole thing. Now, that's their right. And I've been there many times, and I am not someone that is an avid churchgoer. I do not wear my religious beliefs on my sleeve. I take it in and I listen to people, but I don't say too much.
Mm-hmm.
But we need to understand what we're dealing with. We're not dealing with people like ourselves. The Israelis are different. They see the world very differently from us, and they think that they are absolutely 100% justified in killing anyone who disagrees with them.
Well, I would just like the bully pulpit of the White House to be, you know, used. Get up and say, look, Lebanon was the first Christian state. Jesus walked there. The Christians are being persecuted, killed. They're worried about 2 million Sunni, you know, Muslims that came in during the Assad civil war, and they won't go back. And so what does that do to our country? Why isn't there a bully pulpit in an effort to, you know, Tom Barrack and Morgan Ortegas are all about disarming Hezbollah, but they're not focused on the Christian element, in my opinion.
This is a very transactional administration.
Mm-hmm.
They will tell you that. Everybody in it will tell you that. So what is the answer to your question?
Mm-hmm.
How many billionaires are willing to contribute money on behalf of someone in the Middle East who is a Christian?
Yeah.
So if something happened, you got to walk in the door at Mar-a-Lago or the White House with a bag of cash.
Yeah.
I hate to be blunt, but that looks like it's the case.
Well, I think media is so key, and that's what we're trying to do here, is just build a free media network that can raise the issues so that because people respond to even a little bit of media accountability. Some of these, you know, even Trump does. You know, if his name gets used in a bad way in the media, he doesn't like it. And that's the way we see it.
I think you and others like you, at least with people under the age of 40, are winning the battle.
Mm-hmm.
Because my experience has been recently that if you're talking to people in their 20s, 30s, or 40s, they're not paying attention to what's in the mainstream media.
Yeah.
They inform themselves very differently from the way my generation does. But my generation, and I go through this repeatedly with friends and classmates from West Point, VMI, they say, you know, Doug, what's you don't get it. None of this matters. And I say, what do you mean it doesn't matter? Oh, well, you know, these people are, they're nothing to us. And look, these people have been killing our soldiers and so forth. Well, my answer to that is most of the soldiers that we have lost are sailors, airmen, and Marines have been lost because they were there.
Mm-hmm.
And the people there didn't want them there. And to circle back to where we started with Venezuela, if you don't think that's going to happen in Venezuela, if you go in there in great strength, you're delusional. No one anywhere in the world wants to be governed, ruled, or policed by foreigners.
Yeah.
There's no understanding. In other words, we're permanently the people with white hats. Wherever we go is good. Whatever we bring is wonderful. And in the middle of this is the Marine, the sailor, the airman, or the soldier who's stuck with this mess. And you know what the average soldier, sailor, airman, or Marine says. He looks around. He says, what am I doing here? There's nothing here. I'm going home. I'm not going to die in this place. So, you know, what do you think you're accomplishing by sending large numbers of soldiers into these areas? You're familiar with Sir Richard Francis Burton, right?
Yes.
Well, that's somebody, given your background, that's somebody you should talk about to these people in the White House. They don't get it. Sir Richard Francis Burton was, in the words of many, many British general officers, worth hundreds of thousands of troops. He was able to go into places and cultivate friendships and relations and establish good commercial relations and avoid war.
Mm-hmm.
We need to get into that mode. We're not there.
Totally agree. Last question. You mentioned, I know you got to go, but I'm an Air Force grad. You mentioned West Point and VMI, two institutions which are critical, I think, to the future. Where are we in restoring those institutions, in your opinion?
Those institutions are largely lost.
Mm-hmm.
They have been dismantled internally. So what you have is the appearance of something, but behind it, you know, these are civilian colleges and universities now where the boys and girls go to school together.
Yeah.
We have to ask a couple of questions. Do we need 18th, 19th century cadet schools?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Is that the answer for the future? Secondly, if we're going to spend $300,000-$400,000 or more a copy, what do we want from it?
Yeah.
The people that have been making these decisions are largely civilians who have no appreciation for military power.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what I always looked at West Point and I couldn't understand why people didn't appreciate the simplicity, but the utility of the attitude. Now, I thought we wasted too much time, and I mean this sincerely, trying to be Yale or Harvard.
Yeah.
So I'm one of these people that thinks that we've got to really re-examine the whole curriculum and what we're trying to do there. But we need to have a sense that you are imbuing people with the understanding that they are being trained and educated to serve.
Yes. And to win.
Well, yeah, but you've got to serve.
Sure.
And, you know, everybody wants to win, but nobody wins all the time. And that means that on occasion you're expected to die.
Well, Napoleon famously said that, you know, winning a war starts with a shine on a boot. I completely agree with that.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, people tear this down. I don't know if you saw it. I was utterly appalled and disgusted by the Army birthday parade.
Yeah, the marching was, it made me almost physically sick.
I would force everybody in the military to watch the parade that was in Beijing. I'd force them to watch the parade in Red Square. Now, I'm not saying that we have to be Russians or Chinese.
No goose step, but just march well. That was a big one. You know, no bebopping, as they used to tell us. Stop bebopping.
And, you know, when I was last up at West Point and I saw some people in formation, it was depressing.
Yeah.
You know, if an instructor spoke to you, you would stand at attention.
Mm-hmm.
And then he would say, you know, relax or at ease or something. There was a crispness.
Yes.
About that interaction, a level of mutual respect, but you understood where you were.
Yeah.
All of that seems to be gone completely.
I agree. I wrote about that in my 30th reunion 10 years ago. And then the Academy tried to bribe me and say, you can't stop. If you stop writing about that, we'll bring you here. You can speak and sell lots of books. And I said, no, but we formed organizations trying to fight this, but we're making progress, but you know, I don't think they're going to go away. So let's make them what they should be.
There's something we have to think about as we go forward in this country. The answer to everything is not to go backward.
True. It's to look to the future.
Go forward and to figure out what is it that we want to be in the future and what do we need for the future? I am an American firster, absolutely through and through. I was never really comfortable with making America great again. First of all, I thought it was a great country anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So you didn't have to convince me of that. But MAGA sort of told me, well, we've got to go back into the 1950s or 40s or something. That's not the answer either. That's my concern about the service academies.
Mm-hmm.
And not each service is going to want or need the same thing, to be frank.
That's true, too. They're all modeled after each other. Yeah.
We need to think about this. And it's not a question of I want everybody to get up every morning and show up in formation at 5:50 in the winter and 4:50 in the summer. Okay, that's part of it, but that's not necessarily the central focus. So we got to ask these questions, and we have to answer them honestly.
Yes.
I always thought if you really want an engineer, which is all West Point was about when I was there for the most part, these were all kids that excelled at solving equations.
Mm-hmm.
Not very many of them could write well. Only a few spoke well, but they were very good at solving equations. So I said, well, if that's what you want, get them out of Rensselaer or Georgia Tech. Are these people going to be good officers? What kind of razors are we graduating? How hard and tough are they? And the problem with integrating women was always the same. Suddenly, things that men did that were unacceptable or below standard were acceptable because you couldn't throw, 10, 15% of the men out of the formation as losers because you had 10 or 15% of the formation that consisted of women, and then you'd have had to throw them out, not because they were losers, but they're not men.
Yeah.
So nobody wants to go there. Everybody is too busy being politically correct. Nobody wants the harsh truth about anything. But anybody who has spent any real time in combat knows there are no extra points for difficulty when you integrate little girls or young women into the organization. If I had a daughter, I wouldn't let her near any of it under any circumstances. Yeah. That's the last place I'd let my daughter go. But, I talked to a senator once, and he's a nice guy. I like him a lot. But he said, well, I think that's a very backward view. Surely men have changed quite a bit. And I looked at him and I said, no, there's no difference between me and somebody who stood in the Roman legions. Evolution, if that's what you're talking about, is a very slow process.
Yeah.
We're not even sure it really works anyway. That's another subject. But the point is, who are you kidding, Senator? What do you want these people to do? Are you raising a troop of Boy Scouts? Are you trying to create Renaissance men? What is it?
That's what they're trying to do. They're trying to create beta males that will do what they say. Shoot the enemy, which may be, a white Christian nationalist in the mountains. That's what they want. I mean,
Yeah, well, I guess that's probably true. I hope not. But I do know that we need a real serious review of everything, and not by old retired people, because I include myself. I mean, I'm happy to offer my suggestions, but we need to take the big butcher paper sheet, put it down on the floor and say, okay, what do we need? What do we want? Let's look at what is in the nation's interest. What's going to produce the outcome we want? Nobody wants to do that, but that's what you need. You need it to do it, by the way, with force structure too.
Yeah.
And equipment and modernization, everything. We've reached that point. But what do we do? I mean, the force, we just drag it through everything. We keep using a force structure that's based on things that happened 80 years ago into every conceivable thing we can find. And then we're surprised when it breaks down, it doesn't work as well as we thought it should, or it's the wrong answer. Well, of course, it's probably not the right answer. So let's answer the question. But I don't know, Todd. I get
great, great point. Well, if you ever want to write for us, let me know on our armedforces.press channel. Would love to have some stuff out there from you. Take care, sir. I know you got a hard limit. So
yeah,
we'll have you back.
Thanks for talking to me. I appreciate it. God bless.